Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I am your host, Massimo Pigliucci, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Julia Gilliff. Julia, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, this might sound surprising to some of our listeners, but we're going to talk about spirituality.
What?
Yes, I know. Well, so to be more precise, we're going to talk about the question of what do people mean when they describe themselves as spiritual or spiritual but not religious? And we'll also talk about...
Oh, we're talking about dating sites. No.
What are you referring to, Massimo? Would you like to enlighten us?
Well, yes, of course. You may notice that on dating sites, on many dating sites, you actually put your, you know, you have option at least to put your religious affiliation or lack thereof. But different sites list different options for non-religious people or for non-believers. Some of them say atheist or agnostic or something. Some of them have an option that says spiritual but not religious.
Yeah, well, it's not just dating sites. I mean, I think it's a common descriptor on Facebook for people to describe themselves as spiritual or spiritual but not religious.
Right.
In fact, spiritual but not religious has inspired an acronym because it's so common. So sometimes people just put SBNR. But anyway, so we will talk about what that actually entails.
Yeah, well, my experience is that spiritual but not religious on dating sites means the person is a cuckoo, mystical, new age kind of person. But anyway.
So how many dates did it take, Massimo, to reach a level of significance that you could publish?
Let's say that was n greater than one.
Well, I should hope so. Mr. Empiricism anyway. Over there.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so we'll talk about how that term is used, what it means. And then we'll also talk about whether there are elements of what has traditionally been the realm of spirituality that secular, rationalist, physicalist people could benefit from borrowing. So, Massimo, I'd be happy to start off describing what I think the term spiritual but not religious means. So it means different things, unsurprisingly. I think that a lot of the time, and this is most often, I think, the case when someone that I know has called themselves spiritual but not religious, I think that it's not really about proclaiming any particular kind of belief system or ideology. It's not making any kind of claim about how the world works. It's more just about signaling a bunch of traits that are considered by a lot of our society as positive. Like, so saying, you know, I'm spiritual but not religious means I strive for wisdom and feeling moved by beauty and art and nature.
Right.
And so there's not any claim to any kind of supernatural or irrational beliefs there. It's just the person's making a statement about their character and what they value. And I think the word spiritual is a pretty terrible way to describe those traits, but that does in fact seem to be what many people mean by it. And then other times it does indicate some sort of loosely defined set of supernatural beliefs about a goddess or some sort of like undefined deity that exists in nature. I think that's pretty common. And then
the balance in the universe, you know, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's often hard to determine what kind of claims the people are actually making about how the universe works. Like when you say there's balance in the universe, is that a prediction? Is that like saying you believe in karma? I don't know. Probably for many people it is.
Right.
And then the other main category of usage, I think, is people who are actually religious, but they, for whatever reason, they dislike organized religion, have had a bad experience with it, find it sort of oppressive or constraining or patriarchal or something like that. And so then what they do is they borrow bits and pieces from different religions and put them together. So
religion by menu.
Essentially. Yeah, and then they'll often also sprinkle in a bunch of supernatural beliefs that don't actually come from any religion. But it is, I would call that religious, you know. It's just not like limited to any one particular religion.
Right.
So do you think that's an accurate description?
I think that is an accurate description. I mean, it covers several of the categories that I can think of. Of course, you know, truly simple, straightforward religious people also presumably consider themselves spiritual.
Right. Well, that's why it's spiritual but not religious.
Right.
So, you know, SBNR.
Right. So which means, however, that then if you say that you are spiritual but not religious, does that mean necessarily that you're non-religious as in, you know, you don't believe in anything supernatural. From what you said, that's not necessarily the case. It's just that you don't belong to an organized religion or a particular specified way of thinking about the supernatural, right?
Right. That's why it's so confusing that people mean different things by it. Some people might be implying a belief in supernatural and others might not.
Right. Now, which brings me to an interesting question, which was raised recently by the publication of a new book by Alan Debaton, who is a British author who has written often about, he's essentially about philosophy. Philosophy in a really broad sense. He has written books about architecture, for instance.
Yeah.
appreciated from an aesthetic point of view and so on. Anyway, his latest book, which I don't think it's out in the United States yet, it's called Religion for Atheists, A Nonbeliever's Guide to the Uses of Religion, which right there has actually sparked quite a controversy already in England, with very positive reviews, very negative reviews, and the negative reviews that come almost equally from religious people and from atheists. It's possible that the guy actually is doing something right, because if he has been able to piss off so royally both the atheists and the fundamentalists. Clearly, the religious person, some religious person, I don't think that's a general statement, but some religious persons find the whole idea of appropriating elements of religion in a secular fashion, which is what Debaton is suggesting to do, and I'll tell you more about it in a minute, they find it offensive, you know, they find it some sort of disrespectful and so on and so forth, despite the fact that Bhutan actually starts out the book by saying that he's highly respectful of religious traditions. He's an atheist, but he's highly respectful of religious traditions, and it's precisely because he thinks that there is something, worthwhile in the religious experience that he's written this book.
But, you know, that's the excuse used by that notorious artist who created a portrayal of the Virgin Mary,
yes,
using cutouts from pornographic magazines and I think elephant dung.
Yes.
And what he said was, no, I respect the Christian religion, and I was honoring Mary in my own way. So, you know, that excuse doesn't actually tend to pacify people. If they feel offended, they feel offended regardless of whether you say that you respect their beliefs.
That is true.
But so can you talk a little bit about what Debaton was actually suggesting we borrow?
What he's suggesting, which I think is actually the reason why a lot of atheists, again, by no means everyone, but a lot of atheists actually got upset. He's basically saying that, you know, contrary to what the so-called new atheists have been, you know, now proposing for a long time, not only the aggressive face of atheism is misguided, but in fact, atheists really ought to learn something from the religious experience, not the supernatural part of it,
mm-hmm,
but pretty much every other part. So, for instance, let me give a particular example. He says that we should build temples to reason and humanity and things like that. So places for meditation, places where people go to think about, you know, the big questions, think about science and philosophy in a contemplative way, just like you do in a temple.
Mm-hmm.
So is a temple or a church is supposed to be, certainly in part, the point is prayer, if you believe in the kind of God that responds to prayer. But most temples are just for, especially in the East, are for meditation. You go there and you contemplate, you relax, you feel awed by the architecture and by the art that is inside. And the Bhutan says, you know, why the heck shouldn't we do that in a completely non-religious way? That is a good thing that religious do. Why not do that? Go ahead.
I was just going to say, there's a temple fitting exactly that description at Burning Man every year. And I mean, they
right, but it's the only one I know of, right?
I guess
I don't know
so.
Other examples, right?
Yeah, I mean, and there are people in there who meditate. There are people in there who pray to various types of gods,
mm-hmm,
and then there are people in there who they tack up photos of, you know, loved ones that they've lost, and, you know, sit and think about them. And I mean, it's explicitly for any kind of contemplation or use, really.
Right. As it turns out, this is not a new idea. It was tried already once, very briefly, immediately after the French Revolution. As it turns out, the revolutionaries did turn briefly Notre Dame Cathedral into a temple of reason.
You're kidding!
And they actually they actually replaced the altar, and they had a ceremony there. And the culmination point of that ceremony was this beautiful young woman coming out and representing the goddess of reason. So it's like,
wow, that's really kind of charming.
Yeah, it sounds like an interesting idea. Unfortunately, like many other things during the French Revolution, didn't last that long. But so it's not a new idea, but Debontant is suggesting that we do this in a, you know, on a widespread scale. And he's, by the way, he's putting his money where his mouth is. He actually has founded a few years ago, I think, something a school of philosophy. I think it's called the School of Life, actually, in London. And he's actually now actively pursuing some of the ideas that he presents in this book. Another one, which I found kind of intriguing, is this. He says you often hear something on the lines that art museums are the modern equivalent of churches, meaning that they are, again, places where people go for contemplation and awe, to get a sense of awe out of something.
I've heard that about gyms, actually. Well, and people go, you know, perform rituals and worship the god of fitness.
Right.
I mean, you can stretch this analogy in any way you want, really. Yeah, exactly. But I'm sorry to interrupt. Go on.
No, that's right. So now, here's the idea that Baton has. I find it intriguing. He says, look, the problem with museums as they are typically conceived these days, now let's talk about a standard art museum like the Metropolitan Museum of Art here in New York or the MoMA. They are organized still in essentially what Debontant calls an academic fashion. Mm-hmm. That is, you know, you find the Renaissance, and then you move on, and you find, you know, a Baroque period, and then you find, and so they're distinct areas that are separated by period or schools or location, that sort of stuff, you know, the Dutch masters, etc. Mm-hmm. And Debontant says, why not reorganize the whole thing with themes that actually are meant to educate and help people meditate on things. So, for instance, you know, a whole room dedicated to paintings that explore the issue of life and death.
I love that idea. I've made that exact same suggestion to any of my friends who will listen, actually.
Yes. And so it seems to me eminently sensible idea.
I don't know that that has to do too much with religion. But
No. It doesn't. In fact, I think that the way he means it is that museums, if in fact the aesthetic experience is an awe-inspiring, you know, spiritual in the mm-hmm. broad sense of the term experience, it is one that is clearly secular. That has originated in recent Western history, certainly does have roots in religious, iconography and religious paintings and sculptures and so on and so mm-hmm. forth. Of course, art existed before that, but a lot of what we see in museums today, it's sort of it originated during the Middle Ages and during the period of religious art. And religious art had, according to Debontant, those particular aims. You know, you in his one of his examples is, you know, you see a painting of Jesus on the cross, and then, you know, that represents, you know, suffering, and that represents courage, and so on and so forth. Or you see a painting of the Madonna feeding the baby, and, you know, that represents maternal instinct and, you know, care for others and that sort of stuff. Debontant says, rightly so, I think, well, why can't we do this without Jesus and the Madonna, and, you know, just turn art into a more secular way of obtaining exactly the same results. I think it's a great idea, and I think actually it's an idea that also religious people would enjoy. I mean, there's nothing about being religious that says that you have to see art in the way in which art historians say it. You know, you can see in different ways. So the book is full of these kinds of suggestions, and it is controversial because, as I said, on the one hand, because some religious people are objecting to the idea that this guy wants to hijack the values of religion or the good ideas of religion. I don't see why not. I mean, the history of human culture is all about hijacking good ideas and throwing out the ones that don't work. So if it turns out that religions did produce some good things and then produced also some bad stuff, why not keep one and get rid of the other? But the thing that surprised me, I guess, initially, and perhaps in you know, hindsight, shouldn't have surprised me, was this fairly strong reaction of some atheists in mm-hmm. England that don't like this idea and that think that somehow this is a, you know, cop out or a cheapening of atheism or something like that. And that part is the part that I really don't understand.
Interesting. Well, my interpretation of that, I have a bit of the same reaction to using the word spiritual to describe attempts to inject thoughtfulness and meditation and feelings of awe and thinking about one's place in the universe relative to the vastness of space. And like, these are all experiences that religion tends to induce. And I think they're very valuable and fascinating experiences and fulfilling experiences to try to seek out. But using the word spiritual to describe them seems to me to be, I don't know, ceding too much ground to religion. Like, it almost seems like, I don't like the idea that religion has sort of a monopoly on these experiences, and that when we have these experiences, we should, you know, call them spiritual.
Right.
I mean, of course you can claim, you know, no, the word spiritual just means things inducing awe and reverence or contemplation or whatever, but that's a lost battle. I mean, the word spiritual basically belongs to religion and mysticism for the most part. At least that was my impression.
Perhaps.
But I've been surprised that at how many skeptics and scientists use the word spiritual.
Yeah, no, that is true. But it's also a matter of there simply aren't that many other good words out there. I mean, I find myself often, you know, saying things like, oh, this is good for my psyche. I don't believe that I have a psyche.
Yeah.
But what I mean is not good for my body. It's good for some, and it's not good for my brain in the sense of the thinking part of my brain. It's good for the, you know, general well-being of my psychology. Fine.
Yeah,
well, how do I call that?
Right. Well, the you know, different tenses or, you know, variations of the word spiritual have vastly different associations. Like, if I said this is good for the spirit, it's clear that I'm not talking about religion.
Right. Although that is still, the root is the same.
I know. That's right. What I'm pointing out. But it's funny that there's such differences. And even the difference between saying that, you know, you feel spiritual when you look at a sunset or contemplate the vastness of space, even that, I don't know, feels different than spirituality.
Right.
But, you know, so I was reading a piece recently by Michael Shermer, who's a leading figure in the skeptic movement, and he talked about viewing a painting by Van Gogh as a spiritual experience. And Sam Harris certainly talks about a lot of things that I wouldn't have called spiritual as spiritual, like contemplation, like meditation. And then, you know, some of the great scientists and science popularizers have also used spiritual to refer to being excited and feeling awe at the greatness and, you know, magnificence of the universe.
Carl
and I don't
Sagan,
know,
famously.
Carl Sagan, absolutely.
Them, yeah.
And I don't know whether they're doing that because they want to make science appealing to the people who think that it doesn't have, like, people for whom spirituality is very important and see science as, like, lacking all of those traits. So maybe they're trying to appeal to those people, but I don't know.
I mean, there is for instance, both Sagan and Dawkins have actually made that argument. You know, Dawkins wrote on Weaving the Rainbow, which I think actually is one of his best books, a number of years ago, and it was exactly about how science doesn't rob us of, you know, the sense of awe. If anything, it enriches.
Did he use the word spiritual, though?
Like, I don't remember. I doubt it.
Although
this was a number of years before The God Delusion.
Mm-hmm.
But the point that he was trying to make was the same point that Sagan had made several times before, which was that just because you add knowledge to, say, I don't know, you're looking at the moon, you're contemplating the moon, and there's this sense of awe, you're looking at a different planet and so on and so forth, and it's orbiting, you know, hundreds of thousands of miles away. And then you also know because of science that really it's a mass of rock that has been, you know, bombarded for forever by meteorites and got a bunch of craters and so on and so forth. The point that both Sagan and Dawkins made over and over was that, yes, but the second bit, the information, the knowledge that you have about that thing doesn't necessarily have to spoil the awe or the sense, the experience, and sort of the, I would say, it's an aesthetic experience that you feel when you're presented with that object. In fact, if anything, it can actually increase it.
Well, I think this varies from person to person. It depends sort of what's fueling your sense of awe. Yeah, I mean, if it's just the magnificence that's fueling your sense of awe, then yeah, I don't think understanding, you know, where the magnificence came from and how it works would diminish it. In fact, I would expect it to increase. But I think for a lot of people, the sense of awe is also born out of mystery.
Yeah.
And so that would reduce. I mean, scientists and science popularizers claim all the time what you just claimed, that understanding the world and the universe doesn't reduce your sense of excitement or awe. But I think that's a person-to-person thing. I don't think that they can make that claim, that blanket statement.
No, that's right. It doesn't. Well, if the claim is that it doesn't necessarily diminish the experience,
well, they're saying
then
it shouldn't, really.
Right.
But I don't even think they can say that.
I think you have a good point. Of course, if somebody's after mystery for mystery's sake, which a lot of people seem to be, then yes, science does spoil the game.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's damaging to your ultimate ability to understand things, probably your ultimate rationality, if you prefer mystery to knowledge and understanding.
Right.
But I guess that's different from enjoying mystery. Like, you can enjoy mystery, but still prefer to know as much as you can about the world.
Right. I mean, you can enjoy.
Except that there's a sacrifice of some enjoyment there for this other thing you want, which is understanding.
Yeah. In fact, I mean, at least the way I think about these kind of things, I enjoy the mystery in part because I think that we can get to the solution. I mean, you know, it's like reading a mystery novel and then somebody says, you know, sorry, I ripped off the last two pages because I didn't want you to see who the culprit was. Yeah. Well, wait a minute. Then I enjoy the novel, but I want to know who did the whole thing. I wanted to talk, however, about something interesting that came out in doing my readings in preparation for this episode, which was the idea of a spiritual path.
Okay.
So a lot of certainly religious traditions, but also spiritual, not necessarily religious traditions, have this concept of a path, meaning that spirituality is about, it's a quest. It's about going, you know, improving yourself in some mm-hmm. fundamental way. Now, it's interesting that one of the examples, you know, typically, of course, the examples of a spiritual path are either some kind of Christian tribulation or, you know, the Buddha's eight path to the enlightenment and that sort of stuff. But actually, one of the first examples that I found was Plato's allegory of the cave
mm-hmm.
as the idea of a spiritual path, essentially.
Can you explain the allegory of the cave?
Right. So the allegory of the cave is one of the most famous in philosophy and in the Western tradition. And it's presented in the Republic by Plato and actually by Socrates, but, you know, it's really Plato writing. Socrates is talking, however, allegedly. And so Socrates presents this allegory, this situation, this hypothetical situation where these people are living inside a cave and they're chained in a way that they face a wall and the outside world projects images on this wall. You know, there's lights coming from the outside and they see shadows of the real world, but they think that is the world. That's the way it is because mm-hmm. that's the only experience that they have. They cannot conceive of anything else. They've never seen anything else. Now, one of these people at some point is able to get rid of the shackles, basically climb outside and take a look at the real world. And in the allegory, the person that is capable of doing that is the philosopher. And the philosopher gets out, and first of all, he's blinded because now there's sunlight. You know, he can't actually make anything out because it's a completely different reality.
Mm-hmm.
Gradually, he understands what's going on. He adjusts his vision to what's going on. He sees how the world is much more complicated, colorful, and three-dimensional and all that sort of stuff. And then he goes back and wants to tell his friends in the cave and tries to start explaining how the things really are out there. And, of course, nobody believes him. They will think he's a crazy cuckoo, that they're just making up stuff because, you know, it's clear to everybody to see that the world is made of two-dimensional shadows. That allegory has been interpreted in a variety of ways, but certainly one way you can interpret it is through the idea that philosophy, today we will say philosophy and science, certainly, is itself a path to enlightenment. That is, it's a path to better understanding not only of the way the world is from a physical perspective, but also the way in which you want to relate to the world. A lot of, you know, Plato was one of those philosophers who actually was very, very uninterested in natural philosophy, unlike Aristotle. He was very interested in, you know, morality, ethics, that sort of stuff. But at any rate, that is the allegory, and it's an interesting, entirely secular allegory because gods don't enter into the whole idea at all.
See, I think that using words like enlightenment or like meaning or purpose or path, to me that sums up the difficulty, the precariousness in adopting spiritual language and practices in a secular and naturalistic context, which is that there are meanings of those words which are perfectly legitimate and important concepts, but they're buried among other meanings which are completely supernatural or mystical.
Right.
And it's often, I think it's really easy when you're using spiritual language, like, the goal of using spiritual language to describe these things is to emphasize the power and beauty and importance of the things that you're talking about, and to sort of meditate on the your small place in the universe, or to meditate on the poetry of science. And there's nothing inherently irrational about that. It's just that the language, like, occupies the sort of fuzzy zone between poetic and actually distorting. So I'll give you an example. Here's a quote from Neil deGrasse Tyson talking about...
One of our former guests.
Mm-hmm. And just an all-round awesome person. So he says, "It's quite literally true that we are stardust. In the highest exalted way one can use that phrase, I bask in the majesty of the cosmos. Not only are we in the universe is in us. I don't know of any deeper spiritual feeling than what that brings upon me." So the line, not only are we in the universe is in us, to me that occupies the pretty safe poetic section of spiritual language. So he's not actually saying anything untrue. He's just saying a true thing in a particularly poetic and moving and awe-inspiring way. Right. And so that's fine. But then there's...
This is, by the way, exactly the kind of things that Carl Sagan famously...
Yes, exactly. I actually looked for a good quote from Sagan as well.
Yeah. He had a similar metaphor. Okay.
So. Yeah. And so, but then there's language about feeling connected to the universe or communing with the universe. Communing with the universe is a good one, okay.
Because what the hell does that mean?
Well, I mean, there's a really legitimate interpretation of it, which is that you're, you know, contemplating the universe and your place in it. And then, like, as long as it's clear that the process by which you're communicating with the universe is only occurring in your own brain, as opposed to you communing with the universe involving something happening outside of your brain.
That reminds me of a famous quote by an American psychologist, whose name, of course, escapes me at the moment, but he said something on the lines of, "It's okay if you talk to God. The problem is if God answers back."
Right. And so, I mean, your discussion of the path and enlightenment, there's a perfectly legitimate use of the word enlightenment, which is just sort of a feeling that you understand things and reaching an understanding about what you value and, you know, what you want to do with your life and so on and so forth. But it also occupies this ambiguous territory that suggests that there's sort of a right answer about what you should value or what the purpose of life is, which I think are philosophically incoherent concepts.
I would agree. But that brings me to yet another sort of treacherous territory, perhaps even actually easier to dismiss in from a certain perspective, but the concept of the sacred.
Mm.
So obviously, again, this is another word that in a religious context makes perfect sense. If you're a religious believer, you know, things that are connected to your scriptures or to things that your God does or does not do, obviously those are sacred in the original fundamental sort of way of, you know, meaning of the word. But there are other more sort of fuzzy concepts of sacredness. For instance, one I find a reference to ecological spirituality.
Hmm.
So this, you know, this is the idea, it's a little bit of a new age idea, but it's the idea that the earth, sometimes referred to as Gaia, is a living system in itself, and that it is sacred, it is inherently worth preserving, you know, the environment is inherently worth preserving, not simply as a good place for us to live, which I would think it's more than reason enough, but as, you know, intrinsically, per se, it's own thing and needs to be respected. Mm-hmm. There's this sense that, and some of these people actually do use the word sacred, and some don't, but they come pretty close. And that's an interesting one. So, is there anything for a secular person, truly secular person, for an atheist or a secular humanist, that really is sacred in that sense? And I'm actually having a hard time coming up with one, but it's possible that. Some atheists do think that there is something sacred.
Yeah, I don't
think so. In that broader sense, not in the religious sense, obviously. Or do we need an equivalent of that word as well? I mean, there are things that there are some principles, or, for instance, or some ideas that I have a very, very high degree of respect that almost comes to the point of sacredness. Well, reason, the value of reason, for instance. In politics, the value of democracy. that sort of as a principle, sort of inherently
yes. valuable.
Well, that's the problem.
Yeah,
inherently valuable. What do you mean? Now, they're in some sense for me, they're all instrumentally valuable, not inherently. Right. Right. Reason is valuable because I think it's the best guide to reality. Democracy is valuable because it's the best system of government, or at least the least worst system of government we've found in terms of facilitating human flourishing. But they are so. I can see what I'm saying is that I can see how you can value something even instrumentally to a such a degree that it comes pretty close to, you know, a sacred thing. Although I wouldn't use that word.
Yeah, I know. It's just whenever you try to pin down and be precise about what you really mean, then the poetry and the awe-inspiringness that you get from the spiritual language starts to disappear oftentimes. I mean, as I was sort of trying to articulate earlier, there are some cases where you can be absolutely precise about what's going on and still have it be incredibly awe-inspiring and feel sacred. And then there are other cases where the only way to get that feeling of sacredness is to kind of be like fuzzy and take some artistic license with the facts about what's actually true in the world. Like, you know, if you really want to be precise, you say, no, I don't really think reason is inherently valuable. I just think it's really useful to achieve certain goals. And so then the magic is is gone.
Right. As soon as you move to instrumental, then it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah. You were talking earlier about the idea of, or maybe it was Alain de Botton's idea of having temples to reason. And, mm-hmm. and right. yeah. So I have a friend actually who tried to do that, not build a temple, but he's in a community of people devoted to studying rationality and trying to become more rational. And he wanted to create a ritual, like a ceremony that would basically do what you were describing and not only sort of reaffirm a commitment to the value of reason and our devotion to being rational, but also to various goals that rationalists have and that aren't necessarily that easy to make yourself fervently care about using just your intellectual deliberative reasoning system. Like, mm-hmm. so goals about doing good in the world or goals about helping people who are sort of abstract numbers in your head because you've never met them and they live across, you know, on the other side of the world. And you're not even helping particular people. You're just sort of, you know, adding some element of higher probability to the fact that some people somewhere who you don't know and will never meet might have a better life. Those are things which rational people often care about intellectually, but it's hard often to translate that intellectual caring into like genuine passion that actually causes you to do things. And so he was doing two things at once, like celebrating reason and also trying to tap into that part of our brain that really responds to ritual and song and poetry. And yeah. the reaction of the community, it was mixed. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that people appreciated the goal. And I think there's a lot of agreement that it can be hard to really keep in mind what you intellectually value and motivate yourself to pursue it with just relying on intellectual reason without the art and poetry and so on. But people were also concerned, and there was a lot of interesting discussion about this in the community, about whether it would, for example, start to dull the rationality of people because they were, you know, by like chanting your devotion to reason again and again, yeah. it's sort of like... It establishes rational thinking as something that you automatically value, like without thinking about it. Any time that you're being induced to automatically do things or automatically value things, which is sort of what ritual does, it seems like a departure from rationality.
It becomes something that reminds me of a famous scene from Monty Python's Life of Brian, where when Brian turns to his followers who he doesn't want and says, "You're not sheep," and they in unison respond,
we are not sheep.
Exactly.
And then he says, "No, you are all individuals," and they respond, we are all individuals.
Exactly.
Except for the one guy who pipes up, "I'm not." Possibly my favorite part of that movie.
But that captures something, what you're talking about a minute ago, it captures, I think, the sense of uneasiness perhaps that that often accompanies the ideas like the ones that we talked about by de Botton, that is, they sound forced. They sound like a little bit of a coercion, a little bit unnatural.
Well, maybe to you and me, like I had kind of that reaction to this idea too, but maybe there are other people for whom this way of motivating themselves and this process of feeling fulfilled feels much more natural to them and less contrived.
Yeah, that's right. And it's clearly the case that not everybody have, reacts in the same way and has the same needs and so on. But my experience in the atheist, humanist, and skeptic communities, which of course are partly overlapping, but not entirely, they're not the same thing, tends to be over and over that, you know, these are communities that are made up mostly of people who are fiercely independent from an intellectual. I mean, they value reason, they value their own independence, their own, you know, I make up my mind about these things based on evidence and reason, which means it seems to have these, I don't know if it is an effect actually or perhaps an underlying cause. Mm. It's interesting. It would be interesting to inquire, you know, empirically on what which direction the causality goes. But it seems like it does make a lot of these people not particularly interested in, you know, social things. I mean, I was living for a couple of years, for instance, in Brooklyn, right literally around the corner from a local chapter of the Ethical Society. Mm-hmm. Nice bunch of people. I actually went there and gave a couple of talks from time to time. And, you know, occasionally I thought, oh, okay, well, maybe I'll bring my daughter there on Sunday morning just to have, you know, the social experience mm-hmm. and so on. And every time that I thought actually about doing it, I said, really? No, let's cook some eggs and, you know, and go for a walk in the park. And we actually never did it. And I suspect that, you know, the idea was kind of interesting, but when it came down to it, I thought we had better things to do than going into a group into a group where people were doing this kind of community building thing that I thought I could do with my friends or with people that I care about. I have a community.
Yeah,
I don't need a structured one.
Yeah,
I have an unstructured community.
Well, maybe that sort of thing is really useful for people who are coming from religious backgrounds. So
perhaps
by leaving their religious background, they are leaving a community, and they it would be nice for them to have a new one sort of, you know, pre-made as opposed to having to build one gradually, which is what we do when we, right. you know, pick friends and get to know them over time. Right. We create our own communities. I have another friend named Scott who's involved with the New York City Skeptics.
Oh, yeah.
And he embarked on this long project. I don't know if it's still ongoing, but he blogged about it. He called the project Skeptuality, and it was his. He comes from a religious background,
okay.
And he was basically trying to go through all of the various rituals and practices from like a spiritual context, and trying to see which ones of them he could get something useful out of, even though he's secular.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, praying. He went through the benefits that praying has for the people who pray, both that it's comforting and that it helps them, make meaning out of what happens in their life and sort of, you know, settle on narratives to tell themselves about how their life is going. And so he was asking himself, can I get those same benefits without actually doing, like, saying something that I think isn't true or doing something that I think is false? And so he details his experience with this. He's tried various versions of praying adapted to, you know, a secular naturalist framework. So, for example, he tried telling the story of his day in his head as if to an audience of one or more people, talking about what he thinks he could have done better and things that he's proud of. He tried picturing personages, both fictional and non, like talking to Carl Sagan or Dumbledore. And then he tried talking to, quote...
Or having them talk to each other. That would be more interesting. You know?
That also sounds interesting, but getting away from the original idea of the Enterprise.
I think so.
And then he says he also tried, quote, talking to my heart, which is an idea put forth in The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho. And he says, even as a non-religious person, I love the metaphor, continuing in conversation with a part of me more in touch with my deep desires and well-being than my conscious mind.
Hmm.
His eventual conclusion after trying all these different versions was that they all felt a bit forced.
Exactly.
And he's not sure what to do with that.
Exactly. I mean, when I feel like having a conversation with Carl Sagan, which I do, I pick one of his books up and read. I know that's not a conversation, but in fact, in some sense, it is, obviously, because he's talking to his readers, and you are, and reading is not a passive activity. You know, you think about it, you react to what you're reading, and so on. When I feel like doing some of the other things that Scott was feeling doing, I'd usually head down to the bar with a couple of friends and have a martini. And yeah. It seems to have a similar effect, and it's not forced.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I agree with you. But for me, it's still an open question to what degree things could benefit people who might be a little, have a different mindset.
Now, we can't do an episode like this without a little bit of neurobubble, just to refer a
neurobubble.
Yes,
neurobabble.
Neurobubble, just to refer to a topic for that we cover in another episode. So, whenever people talk these days, there's a lot of the neurobiology of. Mm-hmm. And spirituality has been one of those things that neurobiologists have attacked, not in the sense of criticized, but in the sense of worked on.
Oh, right.
And so I found this really interesting article, if somewhat maddening, and our listeners can judge for themselves, because we'll put a link to it on the website. But the article is, it's an NPR piece, actually. It's a National Public Radio piece. Mm-hmm. From June 3rd, 2009, by Barbara Bradley Agati, who actually does often pieces on spirituality or religion for NPR. Anyway, so she was talking about the title of the article is "Are Spiritual Encounters All in Your Head?" To which the answer I would think is, well, yes.
must be a short article.
They have to be. No, okay. That's right. They have to be, right? In some sense. Even if there were a spiritual world, that even if there were a God out there that were talking to you, it would still be talking to you through your head. So yes, in some very important sense, ought to be in your head. Whether they are out there or not, it's a different question.
Then it's a semantic. Right? You're quibbling with her choice of words.
No, I'm quibbling with what I have noticed is a trend in interpreting, I think, in a facile way, research in neurobiology. For instance, let me give you the example for this specific case. So the article talks about this guy, his name is Jeff Schimmel, and he was a writer in Los Angeles, was raised a conservative Jewish home, but never bought into God until he was touched, as Barbara Agati says, by a being outside of himself. What actually happened, is that this guy had a problem with his brain, literally. He had an overgrowth. His left temporal lobe was completely different from the way it was before the surgery. He had surgery. As a result, he had scar tissue. This scar tissue had interfered with certain areas of the brain that started generating these auditory hallucinations and these messages from outside, which he interpreted actually as, interestingly, at some point he actually had a visual hallucination. He remembered lying in bed, and he had looked up to the ceiling and saw this swirl of blue and gold and green colors that settled into a shape. And he said, "Oh my God, it's the Virgin Mary." Okay, now you can say that was he counted that as a spiritual experience. And interestingly, this guy who was not religious and not interested in religion became religious as a result of these experiences.
Yeah, I mean, I find cases like that fascinating, but I'm not sure how much they tell us. I'm not sure how useful they are to explaining spiritual experiences in general, because a lot of people have what they can consider that they hear the voice of God, or that they feel God reaching out to them. And we can't explain those with, brain tumors or anything like that.
No,
and
we can't. I mean, certainly not. But one of the things that can happen, actually, is that there's a good number. It's not that uncommon for people to actually have microseizures, and microseizures in the brain can cause that kind of hallucination, not as on a regular basis, but sort of on an occasional basis.
But people say that they hear God talking to them even when they're just meditating or praying or something. So I think we need a broader explanation of how this stuff happens. Not that those cases aren't fascinating in their own right.
They are, but my point in bringing this up was this, that as a secular person, my obvious reaction to this kind of experience is, well, what do you mean you were touched by God? Clearly, this was the result of your operation. Your brain was malfunctioning, and that's why you had essentially hallucinations. Even so, those hallucinations have actually changed his whole attitude toward life and spirituality in general, and so on and so forth. Which means that apparently the change was largely positive. Meaning, he's become, he feels happier, he feels like a better person, and so on and so forth. Now, so the explanation for what triggered the thing is physically pretty obvious, biologically pretty obvious, and doesn't seem to be much of a mystery to me in there. But it's interesting that it did have a, sort of cascade of other effects that apparently were largely positive. Now, the secular person can say, secular person in me says, well, here's the explanation of what happened, you know, the scar tissue in your brain. But of course, as I mentioned earlier, when you were making fun of me, everything...
When do I do that? When have I ever made fun of you, Massimo?
Never. No, but seriously, that since every single experience that we have about the world has to be mediated through our brain in a very complex and totally non-trivial way. I mean, you know, our brains are sort of essentially building this virtual reality all the time. Mm-hmm. And we navigate this virtual reality that the brain builds, not the actual... We don't have actually any physical direct access to the way that the world is. So when somebody says, well, here's what happened... you know, your brain fired in a particular way as a way sort of to explain what happened. It really isn't much of an explanation under normal circumstances. In this case, it was clearly a pathology. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to say, this is not a real experience because it was in your brain. All of the experiences are in our brain. If they're real or not, it doesn't matter. They have to go through our brain. Otherwise, we're not going to have experiences, period.
And right. So, I guess the question is, you know, was someone else having the experience of talking to you?
Correct.
Or were you the only person having the experience of that conversation? That's all.
Correct. But on the other hand, but even that one, of course, has limits, right? Because, I mean, we have all sorts of private experiences or private thoughts that we don't share interpersonally. And that doesn't mean that they're not real, meaningful, pertinent, whatever it is.
Sure.
So what I'm saying, I guess, is where I'm going with this is that neurobiology is largely relevant to these kinds of questions.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, it can tell us, of course, how is it that the brain generates certain experiences. And mm-hmm. that's interesting from a scientific perspective, and it's interesting, you know,
right.
so to know. But it really doesn't tell you anything about the meaning or the value of those experiences, not even, in fact, literally about the actuality of those experiences in a sense, external to the individual. I don't think that there is any such thing as an external source of spiritual experience in the sense of a supernatural being or anything like that. But if somebody is doing transcendental meditation and they have this feeling of unity with the rest of the universe, you know, I can point to their brain scan and say, well, yeah, of course you have that because all the areas in your mm-hmm. brain that deal with proprioception are shut down. Mm-hmm. So you don't have a feeling of where your body is ending. And so in some sense, meditation is essentially bringing out a malfunction of your brain. That's why you feel at one with the universe. And, you know, I think to me that explanation makes perfect sense, but it doesn't diminish the value of the experience for the person who's actually meditating.
Right. Right, indeed. We are about to move on to the Rationally Speaking picks, but first I just want to remind all of our listeners that the fourth annual Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism is coming up this April 21st and 22nd in Manhattan, New York. Massimo and I will be there recording an episode of the Rationally Speaking podcast live, and there will be a great lineup of other speakers and panelists and performers who you can check out on the Nexus website while you're going there to register and buy your tickets. The website is www.nexus.org. That's NECSS.org. We hope to see you there. And now we'll move on to the Rationally Speaking picks.
Welcome back. Every episode, Julie and I pick a couple of our favorite books, movies, websites, or whatever tickles our rational fancy. Let's start, as usual, with Julia's pick.
Thanks, Massimo. My pick is an article. It's from 2007 from the American Educator magazine, and it's called Critical Thinking, Why Is It So Hard to Teach? I thought it was a fantastic and really enlightening explanation. No, I'm sure you have experience with this.
I teach a regular course on it. Yes, it is difficult to teach. What was the article's point?
The point wasn't so much getting people to understand the concepts that you're trying to teach them when you teach them critical thinking. It was more about getting people to be able to apply those concepts outside of the classroom environment. And people have a terrible track record of that. I mean, even giving people... who have taken a critical thinking course and learned about a concept like, say, selection bias, giving them a reasoning question on a test 2 weeks later where selection bias is clearly in effect, but the question involves some context other than the one in which they learned about selection bias. Like, say, it's, I don't know, about a question about how successful singers overestimate the ease with which you can succeed in singing. There's a selection bias there because you never get to talk to the unsuccessful singers. Anyway, that's an example of the phenomenon. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people won't occur to them that regression to the mean that selection bias is happening there because they, I don't know, people, the point of the article, which I thought was such a good one, is that our memories are very domain specific. And so when we're looking at a problem or a situation in one context, like the context of singers, when we're thinking about that issue, we search our brains for concepts that are relevant to singing. And that's how our brain does searches, essentially, for the most part. And that's why critical thinking is so hard to teach, because critical thinking principles are these abstract principles which are not particular to one domain or situation. And so whatever situation you use to teach people about them, people may remember to use them in that situation. Like you know, teach people about the gambler's fallacy and people remember it when they're gambling, hopefully. But yes. But it's hard to get them to
not
recall
in Vegas,
that
apparently.
Concept. Yeah. Well, they haven't necessarily learned about the fallacy, but it's hard to get people to recognize the relevance of the principles right. in context that they didn't learn them on. And I think that's a fundamental challenge that that we're going to have to face as we figure out how to teach critical thinking.
Right. Well, my pick is also an article, and it's also not that recent, actually. It's called Buddhist Retreat, Why I Gave Up on Finding My Religion, by John Horgan. And it was published in 12th of February 2003 in the Slate magazine.
Well, at least your pick is much more relevant to the episode than mine is. You win the relevance, friend.
Okay, that's good. So you hear a lot these days, even among secular people, that Buddhism, unlike other religions, or maybe it's not even a religion, it's different, it's got something to teach and some values and some approaches and so on and so forth. There are value, even a value in a secular world. And Horgan basically puts very clearly on paper, in my case, electronic paper, what I always thought about Buddhism, not knowing as much as he has done it because he's actually practiced it and done research on it. Which is that's really not true. First of all, it is, in fact, a religion. There's a variety of forms of it, of course. But it does share a lot of interesting and not positive, I think, aspects of other religions. So one of his examples was, you know, this the idea that Buddhism started with Buddha leaving his family.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a thing that actually you find also in, you know, the New Testament, for instance,
yeah.
in Christian tradition.
It doesn't come up very much in the family values contingent
exactly.
of the U.S. political spectrum.
And that's exactly this author's point. It's like, wait a minute, but what that means is that there were people left behind that,
right.
you know, were sort of suffering and, you know, and all that sort of stuff. He goes through several examples, several of these reasons for why he has become disenchanted with Buddhism. It does that in a critical but, you know, interesting way. He's not dismissive of the whole thing. He tried it and he's telling us what he learned. And I thought that was particularly interesting the way he ends the article, which is, you know, Buddhism raises radical questions about our inner and other reality. He's referring to, of course, you know, the idea of the consciousness is really an illusion and that sort of things. But it is finally not radical enough to accommodate science's disturbing perspective. The remaining question is whether any form of spirituality can. And it's an interesting question.
Yeah.
I will add that the additional question is whether any form of spirituality ought to. Is spirituality in the same business as science in terms of answering questions? Because if the answer is yes, then you got a problem. But if the answer is no, spirituality is a way for me to make sense emotionally or aesthetically or whatever it is of the world as it is and how science tells me that it is, then that is not the question. Then it's a separate question.
Oh, Massimo, no fair, raising really interesting discussion questions at the very end of our episode time. We are, unfortunately, all out of time for this episode. So this wraps up another episode of Rationally Speaking. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.